when we were talking about Jesus crucified, and we talked about John 19, where it says that not a bone of him would be broken. And we kind of went back and we talked about the Passover lamb, and we talked about kind of all the foreshadowing there. Sorry, it had to have the F. What's that? I hope not. Maybe I should try to make my whole teaching time without any F's. That'd be even more interesting. Right. So, anyway, going through that, we're talking about them not breaking a bone. Not a bone of him would be broken. You know, and we looked at the Passover lamb and how that was foreshadowing Jesus and how they wouldn't break a bone of the Passover lamb. But I forgot to actually take you to the quote, which is from Psalm 34. So let's look at that. And I particularly like the context of Psalm 34. If you look there at the very, very, very beginning, prior to verse 1, in the inspired text part, it says, a psalm of David when he feigned madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. You know, it's one of my personal favorite stories. I have lots of favorite stories, but that's one of them. Just when David heads into the Philistine camp and is going to kind of seek some refuge there and begins to realize that they're not quite as fond of him as he had hoped they would be. He was fleeing from Saul. And so he gets there and realizes, hey, they're thinking that, you know, they're remembering that I killed Goliath. They're remembering that kind of stuff. And so he feigned madness. You know, he starts drooling all over himself and, you know, acting, you know, and so Abimelech kind of goes, this can't be David. You guys who thought he was David, you must be mistaken. And so, yeah, lets him out of there. So when Paul talked about being beside himself for Christ, I think, you know, sometimes if some of us seem a little crazy, there's a reason for it. So David here, he's feigning madness, but he gets away. And he then has a psalm of praise to God. But in that, in the midst of that psalm of praise, let's get from verse 19. You know, and this is the reason I remember this morning is I've been, you know, as I'm praying through psalms and stuff, I'm actually in Psalm 34 in my prayer time. And I was praying through this, got some excellent stuff in there to pray through, by the way. And but I saw this and went, ooh, I forgot that. So, verse 19, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. See, here in this, it's generally just a psalm of praise to God for how he delivers us, how he delivers the righteous out of the hands of the wicked, how he takes care of them. And in the midst of that, he just slides this verse right in there. Just kind of sticks it in there, talking about the afflictions. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, which even in the Old Testament times, even in the times when God's blessings tended to be more physical, yet he still says, many are the afflictions of the righteous. You know, it seems like that it's always kind of been part of God's plan that the righteous will suffer. But he goes on and says, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. A little advice for us, too. Remember that, you know, yep, many will be your afflictions, but the Lord will get you out of them. Now, maybe not the way that you expect to get out of them, but he will deliver you out of them. But then verse 20, he keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. So that means that if you're righteous, you'll never have a broken bone. Okay, maybe not. In that case, I am far from righteous. I tend to break bones. But just kind of snuck right in there. You know, and you can kind of see how it fits in there. Okay, that's the whole idea of God delivering him. And so, yeah, he keeps all of his bones. Not one of them is broken. You know, still the deliverance of God and all. But it's kind of a strange little thing to stick in there. John, inspired by the Holy Spirit, picked up on it and went, I know what that's talking about. It's talking about one person in particular that was afflicted because he was righteous. And the Lord delivered him out of those afflictions. Again, it's not necessarily going to be the way that you would want it. Jesus didn't really get delivered from the pain and suffering. You know, flip over to Hebrews chapter 5 for a minute, please. A few years ago, when I was working on memorizing Hebrews, when I got to chapter 5 and I worked through some of these verses, there was a verse that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, parts of it did, yes. But there was a part of the verse that didn't really make a whole lot of sense. And then just within the last couple of years, Mr. Wilson just said something and it just stuck. Which, side note, totally a side note, one of the excellent purposes or one of the excellent reasons to be working on memory work is because you will pick up more from every message that's preached. Because anytime there's anything, when the person who's preaching says something about something you've memorized, your ears instantly perk up. You're paying much more careful attention to that because it's something you're familiar with. So just that's a little plug for memory work there. But he went through this and suddenly it clicked. I went, that's what it meant. Down in verse 7. Hebrews 5:7 says, in the days of his flesh, speaking of Jesus, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his piety. You know, for a long time, that didn't make sense to me. Okay, you know, I could make sense of the loud crying and tears and offering up prayers and supplications. You know, the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is there and he's praying and, you know, we have it recorded that he said, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but your will be done. We have that one recorded. But this gives us the idea there's a whole lot more going on there than what's recorded. And the fact that I believe it's Luke says that his sweat was coming like drops of blood gives you the idea of the intensity of those prayers. And here we see it was with loud crying and tears. I mean, he is really... not, you know, it's an incredibly emotional and difficult time that he's going through right there. And so with that, he's praying to the one able to save him from death. Okay, so God's able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his piety. And I thought, okay, he was heard. He's able to save him from death. He was heard. So why'd he still die? And it wasn't making sense. And then if you look at that little note, some of you might have a little alternate translation or literally, or actually this is an alternate, but it says, or out of, able to save him out of death. You know, and the thing that Mr. Wilson pointed out that made it, that it kind of clicked with me was, as he's praying there and he's got that loud crying tears, he's praying to the one who's able to save him out of or save him through death. It was bring him through the other side. It wasn't just save him from dying right now. It was to raise him up and to bring him out of death. So he was heard because of his piety, which would give you the idea that part of the resurrection hinged on that night of prayer. So, you know, you never know what might hinge for you on some prayer, some things that you might run into in the future. But I have to think about why I was going there. Not going to break any bones. Got this little verse slid in there. Oh, I remember. Because he was talking about in Psalm that the many are the afflictions of the righteous. You know, and you get Jesus, many were his afflictions, yet God delivers him from them all. That doesn't mean, you know, you're righteous, so you're not going to have any afflictions. He says, no, you will have afflictions. He will deliver you from them all. But like Jesus, you know, it's going to be on the other side. After you have made it through, that's where your deliverance is. You know, Jesus, he was heard because of his piety. Yeah. And so he was saved from death in that after he had died, he was raised up. But in the midst of all that, John makes the connection, not a bone of him shall be broken. In Psalms, it looks like it's talking about just the righteous guy. Righteous people don't have broken bones. But that's not what he's saying at all. John picked up that was specifically speaking about Jesus and made that connection for us. So that was what I forgot. Anybody have anything you want to add to that? Going once? You don't get advice. Okay, let's go back over to Matthew chapter 5. We started looking at the red letters. And in Matthew chapter 5, what we have is Jesus is, in a sense, cranking, not so much cranking things up, but helping people to realize what God's standard is. You know, and so, you know, he talks about the righteousness. I say to you, verse 20, I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. And outwardly, yes, you know, you'll see lots of times where Jesus will kind of lay out that, yeah, the scribes and Pharisees, they are supposed to be the standard of righteousness. They at least claim to be. In Matthew 23, he says that, you know, that do as they tell you, but not as they do. You know, here, as you keep going in this discussion that he's having, because he's going to get in Matthew chapter 6, he really talks about verse 1. Let's actually jump forward to that. Verse 1, beware of practicing your righteousness. Sorry, 6:1. I don't know if I told you the chapter. 6:1, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. And then he starts going through and he talks about your prayers. He talks about the giving. He talks about the praying. Praying, giving, fasting. Gets fasting in there. You know, he talks about those acts of righteousness. And he talks about the hypocrites, but it's also those hypocrites are the scribes and the Pharisees. Which you'll find Matthew 23 talks about that some. But he talks about the things that they were doing. They were giving, but they're doing it publicly. They're doing it so everyone can see. And so Jesus says, you know, don't let your right hand know what your left hand's doing. Now, if you can figure out how to do that, let me know. I don't know if you just kind of see, if you're not letting your right hand know, then your right hand, you got it hidden behind your back so I can't. You know, the whole point is you're not doing it publicly. Mel.
I can't play a piano. I can't play any instrument, but I have to see a person who plays the piano. They don't let their left hand know what their right hand is doing.
That is true. I theoretically can play a piano, but my right hand always knows what my left hand is doing, which is why I don't play a piano very well. So yeah, you're right. The whole thrust of it is, you know, it's not to be before men. It's not, you're not doing it to be seen by men. Yet he obviously says there were those who were. And given the context all the way back in 5:20, that it's the right, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. That's the righteous. He's dealing with, yeah, this is their righteousness. This is their standard of righteousness. This is what they have set up as what they think the standard is supposed to be. And he says, no, yours has got to go beyond that. So even when he talks about the giving's done in secret. Hence the reason there's a box at the back and you just don't generally know who's putting in and who's not. Now, I know that because of our current society, checks and all do, it's kind of hard to hide some of those things, you know, but I guess it's not impossible though, if you really chose to, but still the whole idea is the box is back there so that it's not that pressure. One of the things that I did in Sinyani years ago, which got me into some of my biggest trouble. I know it's hard to believe that I would get into trouble. Such a nice guy. But one of the things that I did was I did away with the passing. They didn't have plates that they passed. You know, a lot of these places, they pass the plate. And I don't know, if you haven't been in a place that's like that, it's kind of weird. But if you grew up with it, as I did, you kind of go, oh, that's what it's supposed to be. You know, you're passing the thing down there, and you know, it's just like passing the Lord's Supper, you know. And you get to watch who takes the Lord's Supper, and you get to watch who puts stuff in there, and you kind of watch and see, okay, I see what you're putting in there. And, you know, and you get to watch who takes change out. And, no, I'm just kidding. but I actually have seen that done, by the way. But so you get it. So you had that going on. In Ghana, what they would do, at least where I was at when I abolished this, was they had a little bag, you know, and they had a bag that they passed along. It had a little stick attached to it, and they'd pass that along, and they go along. Well, you know, so I guess that was supposed to be, this is how you can do it in secret, because you can kind of stick the money in there and get it all wadded up in your hand, and you just stick your hand down the bag. The only problem was the people who put empty hands in the bag and brought empty hands out, you know, because everybody's still watching. So you don't want the bag to go by you, and you don't even... You don't put anything in there. You got to put something in, right? See, it's all that outward thing. The thing I love the best were the Pentecostals. They would take the box, put it on a little stand, and then they would set it up front. And after, you know, before the preaching or whatever, and sometimes at various times during it, during the assembly, then... they would have their time, and they'd start playing some music, and you get to go dancing up there. And you go dancing up there, and you put your money in. Of course, some people would go back, and they'd stand at the back, and they'd get changed so they could dance by there about 3 or 4 times so they could put more in. Well, they put the same amount in, but they got to dance more and got to be seen more. You have no idea how much of a show that can become. You know, I have seen it on the showmanship. You know, you're thinking we want to try that, huh, Karen? Yeah, that would be great. So, you know, yeah, it can go to extremes. But that's the whole thing, you know. So, you know, not letting the right hand know what the left hand's doing. You know, Jesus, I mean, we kind of laugh about it because it is a little ludicrous to think of. I mean, you can picture it just for a moment. Today, Mr. Wilson grabs the box and sets it up there in the front, and then everybody gets to go dancing by and put their money in.
I got to see Mel.
Well, yet you look at Jesus' example, and it's not that much different. You know, that's why when, you know, some people read verse 2 and go, you know, when you're giving alms, don't sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and the streets. You know, I've heard people try to go, well, you know, that was, he's just speaking kind of metaphorically, or trying to speak as, you know, it's just trying to make a point there with it. Now, I think it was probably really going on. I mean, judging from what I have seen, I could see very well, very easily how that would happen. You know, because when people are giving for the purpose of being seen by others, they will do everything they can to be seen. And sounding a trumpet wouldn't be that strange of a deal. Okay, so... But Jesus' point is, okay, that's outward righteousness. You know, everybody knows they're giving because they're letting it be known in whatever fashion they choose that they are giving. You know, I went to a Bible college, and the Bible college was plastered with little nameplates everywhere. This window was donated by this person. This window was donated by this person. There was one place that we would sit in that every seat had a little name thing on it. This seat was donated by this person, and this seat was donated by this person. That was Bible college. I'm not really sure where the Bible came into all that. But that, you know, that kind of thing, Jesus goes, no, you get your reward in full if you do it that way. His point is, yeah, you can do it outwardly to be seen by men, perform your acts of righteousness to be seen by men, or you can do it in secret to be seen by God. Talking about praying, same thing with the praying. You know, I'm sure you guys have heard, and I know I have. And see, Ghana, some of the stuff, you really get the opportunities to see it in Ghana. But you would, you could actually have guys standing on a street corner praying out loud for everybody to hear and see. It really happens. You know, and you know, why are they doing it? To be seen by men. Jesus says, okay, Pharisees are doing this. They want to pray. They want to have these nice long prayers. They want to sound wonderful, you know, and sound very holy, which sometimes prayers like that can be very impressive. But, you know, some people are very eloquent. And so they pray, and they pray eloquently. You know, they would probably be big speech makers. He says, pray in secret. What are you doing in secret? You know, goes on and talks about the fasting. And they're fasting for everybody to know. And that goes on too. It says, in secret. See, the whole emphasis, if you look, Jesus is giving a contrast. He says, okay, this is what the law says. This is what these guys are doing. And this is what I'm telling you, the way it really needs to be done. And so, Matthew chapter 5, when he's quoting all these Old Testament scriptures, he's going, here is what the law says. And yeah, these scribes and Pharisees, yeah, their righteousness is good. It looks good. You know, we already saw it. He hits later in chapter 6, the praying, the fasting, and the giving. But, you know, you shall not commit murder. I'm sure the Pharisees were very good. I mean, you probably didn't have a scribe or Pharisee that was guilty of murder. But when he says, talks about, you know, the brother and being angry and, you know, and Raca and you fool, and talks about being reconciled. You know, verse 25, Matthew 5:25. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, in order that your opponent may not deliver you to the judge, and the judge to the officer, you'd be thrown into prison. You know, you won't get out of there until you pay the last cent. You know, all those kind of things. He's talking about the anger that's involved there. He's saying, hey, you know, don't murder. He says, but really, what we're getting at here is don't even be angry. You know, and not the righteous anger. There is a difference when you're talking about anger. There's a difference between righteous anger, the anger of God, and the anger of man. James talks about that. You know, that the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Ephesians chapter 4 says, be angry, yet do not sin. So anger itself is not the sin that he's talking about here. In the deeds of the flesh in Galatians 5, he talks about outbursts of anger. It's the anger of man is the uncontrolled anger. It's the one that's not chosen. Jesus was angry. Scripture says he was when he went and cleared out the temple. He was angry. But like we talked about, he went in there, he saw all of it. He went back and he came back the next day. This is the second time. The first time, you don't have that recorded. But the second time that he went in and did it, he went back the next day and cleaned it out. Yeah, he was angry, but it was by choice. It was a thought out, this is a right time to be angry. I'm going to be angry about this. The anger of man, on the other hand, that's the sin, is the one that's an outburst of an anger. It's the one that's not chosen. It is chosen, but it's the one that's not thought out and planned. And that you choose, after thinking it all out and kind of getting your plan, then you choose and say, yep, I'm going to be angry about this. Now, the one most commonly seen is the anger of man, is the outbursts of anger.
There's some dichotomies that exist in what we're talking about this morning. One of the things, though, that I think helps make things clear about it is back in Matthew chapter 5, verse 16, where it says, let your light shine before men in such a way And the in such a way, I think, is to help us deal with that particular dichotomy, because for one thing, you can do things to receive your reward now. That's being done in such a way that you'll receive your reward now. It will be evident to other men and women alike. But also, if you are doing it for the right reason, the paradox in that is that you're going to be accused by the unrighteous of doing it for the wrong reason. So there's still the necessity of doing it for the right reason, regardless of what somebody else is going to say or think about it. There's
right. Which is not necessarily what Jesus is dealing with here, but you're correct. You know, when he says, "Let your light shine before men," that's a good point. That the deeds of righteousness do eventually. I mean, if you are righteous, you will do acts of righteousness. And again, it does initially come down to the motivation of the heart. You know, so it will, you know, if you are righteous, if you are, you know, not being angry, then obviously you're not going to go commit murder. But on the flip side of it, if you are righteous and you are praying, then eventually at some point in time, those prayers will be seen. I mean, it will be seen when you're sitting in a restaurant. It doesn't mean go hide it. You know, that's what he talks about earlier, about hiding that light. You know, it doesn't mean that when you're sitting in the restaurant, I think, Jeff, were you the one that was talking about that one? Somebody was talking about that recently. Sean. Yeah, that's right, Sean. That you're sitting in a restaurant. Okay, if you're only praying in the restaurant so that everybody sees, that's what Jesus is talking about. But if prayer is such a habit that when you're in the restaurant, you pray because it's the habit, that's different. Outwardly, it may appear the same, which is the point that you're making. Outwardly, it may appear the same, but the important thing is, where is it coming from? What's the motivation? What's the reasoning behind it? With the scribes and the Pharisees, they were doing their acts of righteousness for the purpose of being seen by men. What Jesus is thrusting at is the true things that he's looking for is on the inside. He's talking about, let's get this going on the inside, which is what he's going to hit then in Matthew 23 when he talks about it, about clean the inside of the cup and the outside will be clean too. Where's your focus need to be? Since we're talking about focus this morning, where's your focus need to be? Focusing on the outside or focusing on the inside? If you're focusing on the inside, outward things will happen. If you're focusing on the outside, outward things will happen. But then the inward doesn't. Focus on the inside, inside and out. And that's the point in Matthew 23. Okay, now, Jesus in his comparison then says, okay, you've heard that it was said you should not commit murder. He doesn't change that. He doesn't say, okay, now it's okay to commit murder. He just says, no, it actually needs to stem from the inside with the anger. Now he goes on, verse 27, he says, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Again, Ten Commandments. He doesn't say it's now okay to commit adultery. He says, drive it to the inside, that you don't even commit lust. That's what he's looking for, is a righteousness that begins on the inside and comes out. It will then affect the outside, which is then why he can go into, in verse 31, where he can go into, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her, it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. See, again, Jesus doesn't change that standard. He doesn't say, okay, now it's okay to get divorced. He says, no, that's not what I'm going for. He says, in fact, it's going to be, you know, drive it to the inside that the marriage is so good that divorce isn't really the thing that you're looking for. You go down a little further. Verse 33. By the way, on 31, I think we talked some from Matthew 19 that Jesus said it's because of the hardness of your heart is why Moses permitted even the certificate of divorce. Yeah, because it's from Deuteronomy 24, where it wasn't even specifically that God says, hey, give her a certificate of divorce, send her away. You know, that wasn't specifically what the law said. You don't actually find that in the law. In that particular context, what he was talking about was, I have to remember this, was if a man divorced a woman and he gives her the certificate of divorce, she goes off and marries another guy. He decides he doesn't like her either, gives her a certificate of divorce, sends her on her way. She can't go back to the first guy. Which is a strange kind of sounding thing. You know, you think, why would anybody ever do that anyway? But I told somebody here, I told Gracie not too long ago, I actually have an aunt who did that. And what made it even worse was it was a father to the son to the father. So things can get really whacked. So anytime you start thinking that we have a normal society, well, we do. It's just like the pagan societies of old. But from Kentucky. Yeah, actually, yes, they were. Kentucky is to like Indiana to as North Dakota is to Montana. You know, it's the same kind of thing. True. And to Ohio. So, okay. So back to that then. So that really, what Moses was working on wasn't, hey, go give her a certificate of divorce. He was acknowledging the practice of the day. He wasn't saying, this is what God wants you to do. He was acknowledging the practice of the day. And so God said, or Jesus works both ways, but Jesus said in Matthew 19, Moses permitted this because of the hardness of your hearts, but that's not been God's intention. Now, I'm not, are you going to take me down that track?
No, just on one.
Okay.
The exception to unchastity. God's intent for mankind married was to see themselves as one. So that in the case of unchastity, that's breaking the oneness and, you know, really with a picture of being bound to another god.
Right. If you remember that marriage is ultimately God's intention as a picture for the relationship between Christ and the church, then it makes sense that unchastity would be someone who is, as he puts it in James 4, the adultery that's talked about there is being someone who is trying to be friends with the world and friends with God. And that's the unchastity. That's the whole picture. You're messing with the whole picture that God's trying to present. Now, notice too, it never does say you must divorce in such a situation. What it says is that's where it's permitted, because the idea is if the person will repent and get things back, you know, that's the whole idea of God with Israel and the whole picture that he has there. Because he still has himself married. He had at that point talked about himself being married to Israel. Same thing when, you know, we'll get next week to Hosea and deal with what Hosea has to say. And we'll have to deal with a little Hosea stuff there. But you get that picture that God's going on there. Michael.
So is he talking about the actual act or the actual thought?
It's a good question. It's a very good question. Let me look. My initial thought, Mike, is that given the context, that would also be viable. That would also be. Because he's talking about adultery. And he's lining it all up as, if your right eye causes you sin, cast it out. You know, the whole idea that the lust is the same as adultery. And then it does look like, you know, the unchastity there, the cause of unchastity could. Let me look. Hold on. Divorce his wife, except for the cause of unchastity. Okay, but the context is the wife is the one who's having the unchastity. Earlier, it's the men are the ones with the lust, I believe.
But 1 Corinthians chapter 7 will delineate the brother or sister is you have a believer, unbeliever situation there. But
right.
It's applicable in both situations. I think it's a matter of Matthew chapter 7, do not judge, lest you be judged, for in the same way you judge it will be.
Okay, I'm not ready to go there yet. Hold on. Okay. Like I said, my initial thought. So we'll go with my initial thought, and if I have other ones by next week, I'll let you know. But my initial thought is, my initial one was yes, but what I'm thinking right now as I'm looking at it, you've got, in the lust regard, looks like he's dealing with men. When he talks about here, he says if a man leaves his wife except for the cause of unchastity, and it looks, I mean, it's, or divorces his wife except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery. Let me look at it a little. I don't want to jump right into it. Because let me look at it a little. Give me till next week. Because this is a can of worms that I'm not ready to pop open without a little bit further thought. So that's where I'll go on it at this point. Randy, did you want to say something on it? Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to your comment of how Jesus said, because of the hardness of your heart. We don't want to forget that. But what he's saying is the hardness of your heart is an internal condition. It's something that can be dealt with. And we today have that same, I guess, challenge before us, you know, that we can deal with that heart condition. So it is something that is internal.
Okay. Yeah, let me go over that because did not intend to open a can of worms, but it's probably if it opens up and it's a can of worms, it probably needs, we need to go fishing with it. So we will fish next week, and we'll use up those worms. So let me come back to that one. In 33, it says, "You've heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord.'" Okay, again. That one's coming from, I believe it's Leviticus, but yeah, Leviticus 19. And it's actually mentioned in Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But the context is, you're making a vow, fulfill that vow. You know, and there's some interesting things with it. If a lady makes a vow while in her father's house, her father hears her make the vow and says, "No, you can't do that," then she's free and he's guilty. If a married woman makes a vow and then her husband hears and says, "No, you can't do that," then she's free, he's guilty. And then you have the whole thing of if the daughter makes a vow in the father's house, he's okay with it. She gets to the husband's house, he hears about it, and he says, "No, you can't do that." Okay, well then she's free again. But if ever they hear about it and they don't change, if they don't say no, then she's bound to fulfill that vow. The whole thrust, then, every time it's being talked about is, if you're going to go to the point of making a vow before God, you make a vow, it says then you need to fulfill it. That was the Old Testament deal. And you actually have Paul, even as a Christian, doing that. In the book of Acts, he's making the vows as a Jew, as a Jewish Christian. So he's still, you know, with their system at times. You know, kind of like the point that he had to try to prove to them that he was still a Jew, even though he was a Christian. There were some things that he still continued to do, just like you're Christians, but still in many ways you're still Americans. You know, Jesus. Now, did Paul recognize Jesus as being the fulfillment of the Jewish system? Yes. But he still made some vows, fulfilled it. You can check it out in Acts. But the point that God makes in that Old Testament is, hey, if you're going to go to the trouble to make a vow, make sure you fulfill it. Well, he goes on in here, and Jesus says, but I say to you, verse 34, but I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it's the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black, but let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything beyond these is of evil. You know, what he's again going totally to the inward, where your word is sacred. Where your word, if you say, yeah, I'm going to do it, then you do it. If you say, no, I'm not, you don't. Where it's not that you have to, you know, because the difference is, you know, when they're making vows, I promise I'll do this. You know, you think of the guy who's out, you know, falls off the ship or whatever and far from sea and promises to God that if he gets to shore that he'll give him everything. You know, and then as he gets a little closer, I'll give you half of everything. As he gets a little closer, I'll give you a fourth of everything. You know, he finally gets to the shore and says, thanks God, and leaves it at that. You know, the idea is, you know, people make vows to try to prove, you know, or take an oath to try to prove that what they're saying is true. Jesus' thrust is your character should be such that you don't have to do that. You don't have to, you know, in a sense, you know, what was it? It used to be a handshake. You know, now it's got to be written, signed, lawyer present. You know, you've got to have, you know, and even then, is it a whole lot more than that? You know, even then, you know, it might be a whole lot more than that. But to try to prove that, yeah, you are going to be faithful to what you say, which you still do for people who don't understand. But he's saying, let your character be such that you really don't need it. I mean, if somebody really knows you, your word should be enough.
Talking about making things internal, I think you can kind of take an opposite look at it. It's not so much that you're doing the oath to prove to people outside or whatnot. It's that in the Old Testament, if you didn't take that oath, then you wouldn't feel guilty if you cheated someone and went back on your word. So he's saying that, hey, I don't care if you didn't make an oath on something, you still need to keep your word.
Right. Good. It is, you know, Jesus' thrust is make it internal. That is, if you're looking at the Sermon on the Mount, that's what he's working on. Make it internal. Because outwardly, that's the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. They had it outwardly. They made oaths, they kept their oaths. You know, they divorced their wives, they gave her a nice certificate. They didn't commit adultery. Didn't murder. They fasted. They prayed. Kind of sounds like the guy I believe. Is it Luke 19? I'm not sure. I have to go back and look. About the Pharisee that's praying. It says, I fast twice a week. I give tithes of everything I get. Outwardly, they were good. But what he's working on is inwardly. It's kind of what Matt was talking about this morning. He's talking about, you know, the forgetting. You know, and particularly on the emphasis of the word. You know, it is easy to slip into outwardly, you're looking fine. Outwardly, you're hitting the assemblies. Outwardly, as far as everybody knows, you're doing fine and dandy. But what's really going on the inside? That's where God's true concern lies. That's what he's really looking at. Now, if you're doing things right inwardly, and if you're really working on what's going on the inside, then the outside's going to, it's going to end up being clean too. You know, so that doesn't mean that the outward isn't important. You know, if outwardly things are looking bad, then odds are inwardly things are pretty bad too. But just because outwardly things are looking good doesn't mean inwardly it is. And that's where it comes down to each individual to take that time to look and ask himself the question, am I focusing on the inward things? Am I being transformed inwardly? You know, the whole renewing of the mind, am I diligent in that so that the outward transformation can happen?